You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
All right, guys, super excited to dive into this week's episode. And I wanted to kind of set the frame here. I've seen messages like this or ideas like this in our Facebook group many times. I think this is kind of the perfect example of the topic that we want to cover today. And we got this from a listener in our community. They say, I'm new here. And a lot of the numbers I see people throw around intimidate me. Not the goal numbers. I'm talking about the incomes, the really high incomes. I'm a mom and I'm the breadwinner for my family. And I would be beside myself if I even made half of what the people in this group are actually making. I'm debt-free, but I'm really trying to figure out what that next step should be and how to really pursue this for my family as a mom that is the breadwinner for the family. Now, honestly, this was the perfect question to ask because this is something that we wanted to benefit from the people that are in our community that have different life experiences. They have tackled this same journey. And today we're going to be talking with Liz, who writes over at chiefmomofficer.org. She is a six-figure breadwinner for her family, but it didn't start there. When she started her career, she was making, I don't know, somewhere in the low 20s, and she has leveraged career hacking and made very intentional choices to make an incredible lifestyle for her and her family, and they are well on the path to financial independence. Very excited about this conversation, and to help me with this, I have my co-host Brad here with me today. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, Jonathan, I'm doing quite well. And yeah, that's a fascinating question, right? And I think it speaks to limiting beliefs. And I can't wait to ask Liz about this, but so many of us think that where we are today is where we'll always be. I think with this podcast, we try to break through that. You can always get better. You can always improve. Maybe it looks impossible to make six figures, but what are the steps that it would take you to get there? And I think Liz is the perfect person to talk about this. And her story certainly transcends beyond that. She's Chief Mom Officer. What a great nickname. She had an article on her site, Moms on Fire. I just love this. I mean, it's such a crucial piece that we need to be talking about here on the show because more than half our audience is female. And this is essential, essential information. So with that, Liz, welcome to the Choose FI podcast.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here today.
Well, what I thought we could start with is go back through a little bit of your backstory and back through a little bit of your backstory. I need to rework that. We'll go back and we'll talk about your origin story. And specifically, you wrote the Chief Mom Officer Complete Guide from going from a low paying job into a lucrative career. And I'd love for you to work through those inflection points and along the way, kind of talk to us about the strategies that you implemented pursuing financial independence with a family of five. You didn't start out making six figures a year, right?
Heck no. That was an impossible dream back when I started my first full-time job. I thought people who made six figures were different people than I was and never really thought I'd get there.
So Liz, different types of people. I think a lot of us do think that way, that people making money or even people who are wealthy, they are different types of people. But now on the other side of it, we know that's not the case. And there is a stepwise process to get from where you were to where you are now. And I'd love to hear, like, what were your first steps?
My very first steps were getting an education. So back when I first started my adult life, I worked full-time in a call center making $22,000 a year. And I knew I didn't want to do that forever. So I knew I had to get some kind of education, but I needed to work full-time as well to support myself. So what I did is I leveraged company reimbursement from that call center to pay for college. So I would work 8 hours during the day and then started out in community college in the evenings going full time for 2 years. And most of that was paid for by the company reimbursement because I had to pay for all that myself. The rest was paid out of my $22,000 a year salary. And after finishing the first 2 years of community college, I transferred to a four-year school where I finished up my bachelor's degree, doing the same thing, working 40 hours a week in the call center, And then in the evenings and on weekends, taking 5 classes that were mostly paid for by the company reimbursement, as well as tax credits. So at the end of the 4 years, I had a bachelor's degree in accounting, which is a field I've never actually worked in, but I managed to get that bachelor's degree in accounting. And at my company, I had managed to transfer from the call center into a different job in IT, where I was making the whopping sum of $35,000 a year, which I thought was absolutely amazing because I had increased my salary by $13,000 a year, which when you're making $22,000, that's, you know, 50% increase. So I was extremely happy, but also I didn't know it at the time, but I was extremely underpaid.
Yeah, Liz, this is fascinating. So let's just go back real quick. Company reimbursement. Is that a perk that just your company offered? Is this a standard thing that you've noticed across many companies? And like, what was that dollar figure? And were there any stipulations?
In my career, I've worked for large companies, and all the large companies that I've worked for have some form of company reimbursement for education. And the dollar amount varies by company, and the stipulations also vary by company. So the one I was working for at the time would reimburse something like up to $5,000 per year. Might have been $6,000. It was a while ago now. You had to get certain grades. You had to maintain a certain GPA, and the degree had to be in a field that was related to something the company did. But since the company was very large, I could get a degree in almost anything business related, and it would be reimbursed. So I couldn't get a degree in, say, basket weaving, because that had nothing to do with anything my company did. But I could get a degree in accounting, because my company had accountants, even though I was working in a call center answering questions about car and house insurance, which has obviously nothing to do with accounting. Some companies have a stipulation that you have to stay a certain amount of time after you finish your degree. My company at the time did not have that, but the company I work for now, where I finished up my MBA using a similar method, does. And you have to stay 2 years afterward, or you have to repay the reimbursement. And I'd say in large companies, that's pretty common. But even in smaller companies, jobs like UPS, Starbucks, and Dunkin' Donuts, they all offer some form of company reimbursement.
Yeah, that's cool. Actually, while you were talking, I was Googling this, and it looks like, yeah, there's this educational assistance tax-free fringe benefit. It looks like your recollection was right. It looks to be $5,250, I guess, either 2018 or 2019. So yeah, it's still right around that 5,000 mark that you recollected. And so that is just, in essence, a gift or a grant. In most cases, you don't have to pay it back, like you said, unless there are those stipulations. But that's just a benefit for working there, right?
Right. It's kind of like a 401k match, except an educational match. You put in the work, they put in the money.
And then when you went to get your bachelor's degree, was it a pretty easy transfer moving from the, I guess, associate's degree or community college to the 4-year college? I think a lot of people have questions about that. And personally, I don't have much experience with it. So like, talk me through the process of, do you have to apply to the university? Was it a state university where there's like a guaranteed admissions, or how did that work?
You did have to apply to the state university. In my case, I applied to Central Connecticut State University, which is a public college in my state. And they have a program with the community colleges where the credits are guaranteed to transfer. So you have to be familiar with the requirements for what will transfer, what won't, how it will transfer. Sometimes the classes will transfer one-to-one. Like if I take an English class in community college, it becomes a credit toward an English class at the 4-year college. Whereas if I took, say, an elective at the community college, that might become just a general elective at the 4-year college, even if they don't have an exact equivalent. So you have to do your homework and make sure that the courses you're taking in community college will transfer, and that they will transfer as credits toward your major. But community college is half or less the cost of a 4-year school. So by doing that path for 2 years, I was able to fund my education and cash flow it, even on a very low salary.
Yeah, that's amazing. I'm curious about financial aid. Like when you went to this 4-year university, at that point, you're an adult, you're making, I guess, $22,000 or maybe $35,000 at that point. Like, do you recollect if you got significant financial aid? Because, you know, on that salary, obviously you can't afford a $30,000 a year school. Like how did that work?
So I didn't get any financial aid. Technically, given my age and the fact that my parents wouldn't fill out the FAFSA, I didn't qualify for any aid. And I wouldn't have qualified as an emancipated person in the school. So I never applied for any kind of aid. So the only money that I got was the reimbursement from my company and then the various tax credits that are available. Can't remember what they were called at the time. They're different than the ones now. So now it's the American Opportunity Tax Credit and the Lifetime Learning Credit. Back then it was something similar, but it had a different name. So no, I didn't get any financial aid. I paid for college out of my salary for what was not covered by the company reimbursement, which was basically fees and books were not covered. So I had to pay for those myself. And the tuition was paid for by the company. And they, at the time, had a policy, too. If you went over the dollar amount they'd reimburse per year, they would save up the extra. So say I spent $6,000 in tuition costs, and they only reimbursed five. So they'd take that extra $1,000, and it would be a credit the next year. So they would pay me an extra $1,000 the following year to make up for the difference in tuition cost. And at the end of it, I graduated with no loans, and I had cash flowed it the whole time, working full-time and going to school full-time.
Liz, first of all, that's amazing. And you can tell just by talking with you for a couple minutes how driven you are and how you're trying to figure out the secrets of financial success. You're willing to put the work in. As you looked around you, either at your peer group or you just did your own research, did you find examples of individuals that had kind of walked in your footsteps? I mean, what did it look like for you to actually map out a game plan for your kind of career hacking adventure over the next decade?
So at the time, it was difficult, although not impossible, to find other inspirational stories of people who had done something similar and try to learn from them. So I would read books and magazines, and there wasn't much available on the internet back then because I'm old. This would have been in the late 90s and early 2000s. Back when there just wasn't much out there. But I would seek out and find these inspirational stories about people who had started off in the mailroom and then worked their way to becoming the CEO of a company, or working moms who had started at a low salary and then worked in a career, and in their early 30s or mid 30s, late 30s, they had risen up through the ranks to earn a really good salary. So I would seek out and find and read these different inspirational stories from different angles and different perspectives to try to see how I could apply that in my own life and my own career. Because when I finished college, as I was mentioning, I made $35,000 a year in my new IT job and thought that was a great salary compared to where I'd been, but it wasn't really where I wanted to go. And at the time, I was also pregnant with my oldest son, and he was born 2 months after I finished college. So once I came back from maternity leave, I was really seeking out stories of people who had even been young moms and risen up through the career ranks. And those stories really inspired me to keep going and gave me a lot of knowledge of different ways different people had approached things. And it showed me there wasn't one formula for success where if you do this and then that and then this other thing that equals success, but that there were a number of different things you could do to increase your chances of getting there.
Okay, well, obviously, we need to talk about what are those different things that you could do to increase your chances of getting there. Thank you for setting me up for that.
So I noticed a lot of different things in common with a lot of the people who had risen through the ranks and gotten to higher salaries from a lower place. One was that they tended to work for larger companies with a lot of different kinds of opportunities to move around into different fields and get different kinds of experiences. It just seemed to be easier to move up in a company where there's a lot of different opportunities versus in a smaller company or a family-owned company. That can be more difficult just because there's less positions open, more everyone wears multiple hats.
Would you say there's an advantage for working for a large company, even if it's a low-paying job?
I would say so, at least based on my experience, because there are so many other opportunities where you can move from that lower-paying job. If you get the educational background and you can gain the contacts in a number of different ways as well.
All right, Liz. So that's clearly the first of these items on the how do you increase your odds of success? But it sounded like you had many more. I'd love to hear them.
Yeah. So another thing that I did that I found was really a key to success in a lot of different areas of my career was volunteering for everything. That's a way to not only network with other people, but also to increase your experiences and your skills in things that have nothing to do with your day-to-day job. So I actually scored my first job in IT. Remember, I said I was an accounting major, so I didn't have an IT background. But I got that job from the call center because I had volunteered to help out on a project where I got to know some of the IT people. they were redesigning an application for car and house insurance. And I would do anything to get off the phones for a while, because talking at a call center 8 hours a day, 40 hours a week, you want to do whatever you can to get off the phone and have a little bit of a break for a bit. So volunteering there led me to telling them that I was wrapping up college soon and I'd have my bachelor's degree in about 6 or 7 months, I think it was at the time. And they mentioned they had an opening for something called a business analyst and that I should apply. And I didn't know what that was, but it didn't involve talking on the phones. So it sounded like a great career move to me. So that volunteering led directly to that first IT job. I also volunteered to help out with a corporate initiative where I ended up being able to speak in front of my entire company of 30,000 people directly because of volunteering for this initiative, as well as I got to know people from all over the company in all different kinds of jobs. And we had a club too called Toastmasters, which people may be familiar with, that helps you increase your public speaking skills. And joining that club in the confines of my company not only let me increase my ability to speak in public, but also let me meet people from all over the company who were interested in public speaking. So it was a form of networking, but not the sleazy and annoying form of networking that I personally don't like, where you just slide up to people and start talking to them about yourself. It was more natural networking because we were all working on an initiative together, or we were all looking to increase our public speaking skills. And those were developed skills that were beneficial longer term in my career, even though at the time they didn't directly increase anything with my day-to-day job.
So I find it very interesting. You said you actually found the Toastmasters Club inside your corporation. Was that accurate?
That's right. Yes. A lot of larger corporations run their own Toastmasters clubs that meet during lunchtime, sometimes in the evenings, but the ones that I've been in meet at lunch once every couple of weeks. Everyone gets together and works on their public speaking skills.
That's really cool. So it sounds like you are the prototypical talent stacker here. You're trying to just put together this array of skills, even from networking and volunteering. Like, those are skills, right? Meeting other people, learning how to speak in public in front of 30,000 people. That's insane. Talk me through Toastmasters, though, really quickly, because I've heard of this before and I have a general sense of what it is. But what does that look like in an hour? Were you someone who was deathly afraid of public speaking like many of us? Or was this a skill that you had to some varying degree and just honed it?
So I would say it's the latter. So I'd always been interested in public speaking. It never scared me to death like it did a lot of other folks. And in fact, I had taken a public speaking course in college where I did pretty well and actually gave a speech about compound interest that my teacher later told me to never give for free ever again. But it was a skill I was interested in honing and getting better at, because I was okay at it, but I was in my early 20s. So I didn't have a lot of experience. And in my day job, which was at that point in time in IT, I didn't have any opportunities to speak in front of a lot of people. I was writing specifications for what screens should look like and what systems should do, which is great, but doesn't involve a lot of presentations. But I knew that was a skill I wanted to have for later in my career, even if I didn't really know how I was going to use it. So the way that Toastmasters worked was that once every couple weeks, myself and the other folks in the group would get together during lunchtime. And it was run as a regimented program where every week there was a series of prepared speeches and then also a section of off-the-cuff speaking, so that you could get used to both preparing a speech on a topic. And there were different kinds of speeches in the workbook, like persuasive speeches versus informational speeches and other kinds. And then the off-the-cuff kind of speaking was to help you learn how to speak in front of a group, even when you're not prepared. Because the prepared speeches can sometimes be a lot easier to do, just in general, because it's a little less intimidating. You've memorized the content. You know what you're talking about. You feel very confident in it. Whereas people can find off-the-cuff speaking to be more difficult because they'll stumble over their words and not quite sure what to say. And Toastmasters also has this fun concept of an ah counter, where they'll count the number of pause words that you use when you're doing your speeches, ums and ahs and, you know, and you like, and all those kind of things that distract from the message that you're speaking about. And I found that helpful because those are things that you don't even know that you're doing until someone points it out to you. And then once they do, you can work on how to get those out of your speeches. So now I found when people are public speaking and it's full of ums and ahs, it's really distracting.
Well, I haven't heard a single um or ah to cut from this entire podcast. So you're crushing it.
Well, this isn't really in public, I suppose. I feel like I'm just speaking to you guys at this point.
Awesome. Somebody somewhere is giving you credit for it, though.
oh, good.
Clearly, you're not afraid of hard work. I mean, your work ethic comes through just in the short conversation that we've had. But I get the sense that, you know, working hard isn't necessarily enough. Like, for instance, you're working on the phones. If working hard just meant, hey, instead of working my 8-hour shift, I'll give them the extra 2 hours for free, that probably doesn't get you to a 6-figure income over the course of your career. And so I'm curious, what does it look like to work hard strategically? What were these inflection points that you were able to weave out, as opposed to that person that just says, I'm going to work really hard at my phone calls?
So you do want to work hard strategically when you want to eventually move up. It is important to be really good at what you do every day. So you can't slack on doing well on the things that you're assigned to do. If you're on the phones, then you need to be doing a good job on the phones. You need to be answering the phone calls correctly and answering the questions correctly. But that's almost a baseline. And if that's not where you want to be forever, then you don't necessarily want to be the best phone person on earth, right? You want to work hard enough at that job to be doing very well and have people thinking well of you. But you also want to be working hard on developing other skills that will get you where you want to go. So in my case, for example, while I was on those phones, I was working really hard in the evenings and on weekends to get my college degree so I would eventually not have to be on the phones. And when I would volunteer for projects, I would make sure to do a bang-up job on those and knock them out of the park. So I would make a really good impression on the people that I was networking with as a part of those projects. So working hard is great, but if you want to work towards something else, you have to work hard strategically in those areas that will get you where you want to go.
So I get working hard strategically. That makes perfect sense. And I want to see like how strategic this is. So this volunteering and this networking and even like the Toastmasters, were you aware interpersonal level who you were working with? Would you volunteer on a certain project if, let's say, there was a colleague who you potentially wanted to work with down the road? Were you that strategic about it, like on that granular of a level? Or is that like too Machiavellian maybe?
So I've heard that that can work well for some people, but that's not the path that I chose to go down. So I didn't pick my projects based on, is there a really important person working on this project or something like that? More because that's just not how I want things to be at work. It was more that I wanted to get to know other people and know what kind of opportunities were out there and get to know people at my level, but in different areas of the company so that I could figure out where I wanted to go. Because like many people too, I didn't have a crystal ball or a picture perfect idea of what my career is going to be 5, 10, 15 years down the line. In a lot of cases, I just knew I didn't want to do what I was doing today. I wanted to do something different, but didn't really know what the something was. And getting to know those other people helped me to better figure out what that something might be one day, as well as has helped me as I've grown in my IT career, because I have a greater understanding of all the different areas of the company just from the friends that I've made through these various initiatives.
Let's talk about being a lifelong learner and using that interest to really help you achieve your goals. What would that look like for someone that's, you know, working inside of a large corporation and is going, in your case, you know, if we're following your journey, you started out, you're making $22,000 a year, you get to IT, now you're making $35,000 a year. Currently, you're making somewhere in the six figures. There's a pretty big gap there. How did love of learning help you, you know, bridge that gap?
So the gap was bridged both through my love of learning and seeking out additional education and these volunteer opportunities, but also having some good people that helped me know what I was supposed to be being paid. So let me talk a bit about the lifelong learner aspect. I already talked about the volunteering, and that helped me learn because I would read up on what it was we were doing and why we were doing it. But also generally, when I work on any projects in my company or I work with any new areas, I do a lot of research and I do a lot of reading on what these projects are doing. What are we trying to accomplish, and get to know the bigger picture of the things I'm working on, the departments I'm working in, as well as the company, which doesn't always translate day to day with what exactly I might be doing today. If I'm writing a document, it might not help me with that. but it certainly helps me in conversations with other people. And that kind of knowledge just helps you to grow in general and find other opportunities that might be available and come up with good ideas that get you promoted and get you those better jobs. So, and eventually after getting my bachelor's degree, I also mentioned this earlier, but I sought an MBA because I really liked reading up on business, and to the point where I would spend my lunch breaks at work often reading articles from Harvard Business Review about different business cases, just because I found it such an interesting puzzle. So I eventually went for my MBA and learned that way about all the different areas of running a business, and got my MBA with a concentration in technology and international business, which then years down the line actually led to me getting a position in my company's international technology organization. So I'd say with learning, there's just a lot of different things that you can do to learn about your company, your job, your project, your industry that will help you down the line in ways that you can't foresee.
Yeah, Liz, I definitely want to talk about those future positions, but I did want to just double back to one thing real quick. So you said you were making 35K in this IT position and you were severely underpaid. Now, was that something where you personally were being underpaid just because you moved from this other call center and they said, oh, we can probably get away with paying her 35K? Or was it like that was the rough positional salary? Or how did you even figure out you were underpaid, I guess, is my ultimate question.
Yeah. So that's a funny story. It was because I came from the call center. I know that for a fact. So at the call center at the time, I had gone from 22,000 to maybe the upper 20s over the 3 or so years I'd been there. And when I applied for the IT job in my company's corporate headquarters, they knew what I was making. So they knew if they offered me 35,000 to me, that would be a large jump in pay. But the way that it happened is I stayed under that manager who'd hired me in for a little under a year. And then I had gotten a role on a different project with a different manager. And when it came time to do my annual review, that manager took one look at my salary and basically laughed because it was so absurdly under the market value for my position at the time. And he gave me a $20,000 raise,
wow,
which when you're making $35,000, a $20,000 raise, and he gave me a bonus on top of that. I believe I came home and almost fainted in front of my husband and my oldest son because I just couldn't believe it. But I didn't know that I was being so underpaid, but he knew. So I was very fortunate that the manager that I had transferred under didn't have a vested interest in continuing to underpay me and instead saw that I was doing well in my job and that eventually I would probably figure out that I was being very underpaid. And if they didn't raise my salary, someone else would pay me more for being in that kind of position. I consider myself lucky in that respect to have gotten a good manager who helped me to see that. It's just at the time I had no background in IT. I didn't know what you're supposed to be paying business analysts at these big companies. My frame of reference was a call center to whom $35,000 was a huge amount of money.
Let's talk about that frame of reference just a little bit more. So knowing what you know now, and you don't know the salary, you're kind of in the same position, but with the mindset that you have now, is there something that you could have done? You know, basically, if you look back, was that just the right way of doing it? Because you were given a shot at something that you didn't have a skill set or a background in. And then once you have it, then you could investigate and then on your own start asking or soliciting a raise. Would that be how you would play it now? Or is there something else that people should be aware of?
Yeah, I think now, especially nowadays, I would not. Because right now there's a lot of information available online about what salaries are at specific companies for specific roles and generally in your industry for your location. There's so much information available now that was not in the early 2000s. That kind of thing was not online. It was hard to find out what people were being paid unless you had friends who were willing to talk about how much they're being paid with you, which is hard to find, especially if you're switching fields, even within the same company. So I think if I was doing that now, I would be doing my research online to figure out about what kind of pay would be fair. Now, in my case, obviously, in the end, it worked out well. And if I had said, well, I don't want this job because I don't think I'm going to be paid enough, and if they weren't willing to pay me what I was worth, then I would have been stuck in the call center another, 6 or 7 months until I finished my degree. And then at that point, I would have had to go out and get a different kind of job, which meant I would have had a totally different career, which would have been interesting. But I would say that now, especially now, you just go and do your research and homework online and figure out what's fair to be paid when you're looking to switch fields.
I want to circle back to that moment when, because we talked about this manager that really kind of took advantage of your lack of knowledge of what a fair pay scale is. But I don't really want to talk about that as much as I want to put myself in your shoes. You're working in a call center. You've been raising your hand. I want additional opportunities. I want to move into a different sector. I'm going to apply for something that I really don't have at this point a justifiable background in. I believe I can learn the skill set. I can, the type of person that can learn anything. I want to go work in IT. Putting yourself in that situation, if it's a binary choice between accepting the job at a lower pay versus like demanding fair market rate and potentially them saying, well, we'll just go get someone with experience. Like, I'm almost of the mindset, and I'm curious from you, that it's almost worthwhile to just say, you know what? I'll take the job, whatever it pays, even if it's less than market rate, because I can always negotiate for it later. I mean, I'm just in the back of my mind, I'm thinking that's probably a reasonable mindset to have. And I'm curious for your opinions on that.
Yeah, I think it certainly is. And in fact, I remember distinctly during my interview for this IT job, when they asked, what's your biggest weakness? At first I said it was coffee, just to get a laugh, which it is one of my biggest weaknesses. But then my next answer was, I have no experience. And I didn't really even know what IT did other than they fixed computers, and I didn't know how to do that. So certainly there is an aspect of, if you get the job, that's often the hardest part, is getting that first job, because you end up stuck in that loop of, I need experience to get the job, but I need the job to get the experience, but I need that to get the job in the first place. So it certainly can be a valid strategy to get a job just for the experience, even if it's not paying what it should, or even if it's not exactly what you want to do, just so that you can get those years of experience under your belt, and then you can go apply for something that's paying more fairly, or that's closer to the field that you actually want to be in, or the company that you want to be with.
Because the alternate is, hey, I'll just go get more education. But then after you get the education, you're kind of still in the same boat. Oh, well, I need the experience as well. I mean, you know, that's kind of like my thought. If the job really matters, the job is what says you have the experience, just get the job and then figure out the negotiation later. And actually, that's the part that I wanted to circle back to, because you've really developed a great negotiation skill set. And I imagine that it's tied to your lifelong love of learning. You know, how do you recommend that someone cultivate that?
So what's interesting is I didn't know a lot about negotiation as a set of skills until I took a course in my MBA on negotiating. And I learned a couple of concepts there that once I knew them, they made total sense, but I had never really thought about them in that framework. So there's two concepts in negotiation. One is the best alternative to a negotiated agreement, or what's called BATNA. And then the other one is called ZOPA, or zone of possible, or sometimes zone of potential agreement. And both those concepts really get you to sit down and think about, well, let's say, what's my best alternative to negotiating this agreement here? So if my best alternative is being stuck in the call center for another 7 months while I finish up school, and then ending my time at school with still no experience in a field outside of a call center, well, that's not a great alternative for me. So when I know what my best alternative to negotiating this agreement is, that helps me to really see what's it worth to me to actually come to an agreement where we're going to be working together. And the zone of possible agreement is where all the different aspects to what you can negotiate for. So in my case, going back to my initial negotiation, I didn't negotiate anything, but there were so many different things that I could have, not just pay, but also time off. You can negotiate benefits. You can negotiate remote work arrangements. So there's a lot of different aspects usually to the zone of any negotiation, and you can negotiate all those different levers differently and come to a collective agreement that benefits both of you.
Liz, that's amazing. I've never heard of either of these. And as you're talking about them, it reminds me of Charlie Munger's mental models, where he has this fundamental knowledge in life that he thinks really helps him in all other aspects of life. And I can see that with this negotiating skill set. And I'm curious, obviously, you can learn about this in college, or I suspect you learned about it in college or your MBA, but can people learn about this online? Like, have you come across any especially interesting articles or sites that we could put in the show notes that would be of help to the audience?
Yeah, I could definitely send you guys a couple of links. It is all available online. There's plenty of information on both these concepts. If you just Google BATNA and ZOPA, it'll come up with tons of different articles, because those are two mental models or frameworks that are well known in the negotiation academic community, I'd say. And whenever you take a class on negotiating or you attend a lecture on negotiating, they usually mention both of these things. But I'll find some good links and send them to you to share with your listeners so that they can see a couple of good articles.
You know, what I love about your story, Liz, is just how willing you are to actually embrace change. And that's critical, because careers are rarely stagnant. In fact, if they are stagnant, something has likely gone wrong. And I'm just curious, as you kind of think through that whole mindset approach, what advice would you give to listeners that are trying to follow in your footsteps? And that's really what's really cool about this. When you look at your early story, you were saying it was really hard for me to find models of people who of what they had actually done. I appreciate you laying the groundwork. How does embracing change really come into someone being able to advance their career?
So in my case, all the big jumps and advances in my career have involved some kind of significant change. So moving from the call center into IT, where I didn't know anyone or know anything about the field, that was obviously a huge change. But over my career too, I've changed projects, I've changed departments, I've changed companies in a different industry. And each change has brought about new opportunities, as well as in many cases, jumps in salary. So I would say that embracing change is one of the number one things that you can do to advance, because in order to advance, you're going to have to basically do something that you're not doing right now. And it could be something that you don't really know how to do very well. And if you're really open to that change and you seek it out and you embrace it, you're going to be able to move up the ranks and move into different fields that will eventually get you to where you want to go. Whereas if you're afraid of change, or you specifically try to stay within a certain comfort zone, you're not going to be able to grow and you're not going to find those kind of opportunities. And unfortunately, the world around us will constantly change anyway. So if we try to stay static and not change, the world will change. And eventually we might find that the jobs that we have or the careers that we stayed comfortable in don't exist anymore or aren't needed. I'm 38 now, and since I started working full-time at 18 in the last 20 years, the industries have changed tremendously. The companies I worked for have changed tremendously. Whole new industries have been invented, and old jobs have become obsolete. So if you don't change, the world will change.
You know, Liz, what's apparent is that over time, you have created your own luck. These things didn't happen by accident. You know, there may have been these little things that were wow, but it's because you are positioning yourself to be ready when the moment struck. And that's really what's so encouraging about your story. I think it's replicable, but I think it requires some patience. Like, your journey to a six-figure income was not get rich quick.
No, I like to say that it's not easy, not quick. It's kind of the hard and long path to increasing your income. And I have to say that I think patience is one of the key skills that you have to have, especially if you want to make a huge transformation in your life. I know it's fun to read about people that, say, graduate and make six figures right out of college, or who become instant millionaires, but that's not a replicable path to wealth or to income increase for most of us. For most of us, it's going to take a lot of work, a lot of time, some level of luck, and being positioned in order to take advantage of those lucky breaks that we're going to get. And all of that takes time. As I mentioned, I started out making $22,000 a year when I was 18. And now I'm 38. So I've been working in my career, increasing my level of education, increasing my income for 20 years. It's not a very fast path to wealth, but it is sustainable. And I think it's replicable by a number of people.
Yeah, Liz, I love this. This reminds me of Scott Adams and his systems thinking in his book, How to Fail at Almost Everything and Still Win Big. And it's what you've been talking about throughout this whole episode, right? Increasing the odds of success,
building skills, networking, having patience, and doing this over many, many years and decades, and just knowing that when you have the system right, you don't have a very minor specific goal of like, I need to make X by a year from now. You've built a system that is almost guaranteeing you success in life. And I just absolutely love that. And I hope the audience is really, really leaning in and understanding like how crucial this is to a successful life, not just a successful, oh, I need to hit that goal.
Liz, so many people are listening to this and they're going to want to connect with you. They're going to want to find out more about the Breadwinner series that you have been putting together over the last several years, where you highlight the stories of women that have either found a field or created a field for themselves where they're making six figures. What is the best way for someone to connect with you and connect with your content?
So I write over at chiefmomofficer.org. And as you mentioned, I have a great series on breadwinning six-figure millionaire women, where I interview women who are the breadwinners of their families, earn six figures or are millionaires, to try and share their stories and inspire other people. Like I was once inspired myself by the stories of others. I also hang out on Twitter at Liz Officer quite a lot. And I'm on Instagram at Liz_ChiefMomOfficer. So I would love if folks connected with me and shared their stories.
All right, now on most shows, that would be the end of the episode. But Liz, on this show, we would love to give you the chance to tackle the hot seat. Are you ready for this?
I'm ready.
In a world drowning in debt and rampant consumption, trapped by the chains of lifestyle inflation, these questions highlight the secrets of those who have broken free. Welcome to the Choose FI Hot Seat.
All right, Liz, question number one, your favorite blog that's not your own?
I would say it's Penny from She Picks Up Pennies. I just love her writing style and her story and the way that she's working toward bettering her financial situation. So love Penny.
All right, question number two, your favorite article of all time? Now, this can be one that you wrote or someone else's.
So my favorite financial article of all time is probably John T. Reed's takedown of Robert Kiyosaki from Rich Dad Poor Dad on his website. It is the longest, most detailed takedown I have ever read. And I occasionally go back to it just to reread it and see how.
It sounds like a manifesto.
It is. It's basically a manifesto. I found it years ago and I still occasionally pop over just to reread it.
It's like stunned silence for me. I don't even know. I don't know anything about this. Can you give us 30-second highlight of it?
So essentially, John T. Reed is a real estate writer, but he wrote a lot about Robert Kiyosaki and the bad advice he was giving and some interesting things about his background that don't quite add up. And I don't know. I just always liked the way that it was written and thought it was interesting to read what was obviously a very well-researched perspective of things that didn't quite add up.
Question number three, your favorite life hack?
My personal favorite life hack is to use the library. So my local library doesn't just have books, but they have DVDs, they have video games, they have backpacks filled with toys, they have cake pans, they have a 3D printer, and they even have a Raspberry Pi you can borrow. So I would say use the library, and if you haven't been to a library in a while, go visit one. And if your town's library is not so good, remember, other towns also have libraries where you can take things out.
That's awesome. Love the library.
Yeah, Jonathan, one thing we haven't said here in probably 100 episodes, choose a five
friends of the library. Get those bumper stickers made.
Yeah, Liz, we are huge library fans. So yeah, that's wonderful. All right, question number four, your biggest financial mistake?
I would say it's buying a motorcycle. I bought one, I think it's like 6 years ago now, maybe seven. And I thought I was going to really want to learn how to ride a motorcycle. And I got a motorcycle license. And a couple times on the road, I discovered I really hate driving motorcycles. So that was probably my biggest financial mistake.
You got a big Harley fat boy. What do you drive?
This was like a little Honda thing. And it just, I don't know, people were tailgating me. And I was just like, I don't like this.
Maybe you should try a scooter, like an urban moped.
I live in the suburbs. I'd get run over. Oh, man.
All right. Question number five, the advice you would give your younger self. Don't buy a moped.
Yeah. Besides don't buy a moped and don't buy a motorcycle, it would probably be everything's going to be okay and you don't have to worry so much about everything.
Awesome.
That's pretty profound. All right, Liz, we have one bonus question. What's the purchase you've made in, let's say, the last 12 months or so that has added the most value to your life?
Technically, this is something I got as a gift, but I would say it's a pizza stone. I got it as a Christmas gift that I had asked for, and I absolutely love it. So our family makes pizzas, homemade pizzas, every Friday night, and we had been using these old metal pizza pans, but the stone really makes excellent pizza, and we use it now for our whole wheat pizza every Friday night.
Awesome. Well, Liz, we would actually love to have you on the show potentially later this year and highlight other parts of your story. It was just so compelling. We knew we wanted to focus on this kind of career hacking process of yours. Honestly, there's so much more to your story. Would you like to come back on the show later on and talk to us maybe about what it's like pursuing financial independence as the primary breadwinner of a family of five and the difference between an emergency plan versus an emergency fund?
Yeah, I'd love to come back on. I really enjoyed talking to you both today. I really hope this information's been helpful to someone else out there, and I'd love to come back and chat some more.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
All right, to our audience, I hope you got value from today's episode. I hope that if you have ever found yourself guilty of thinking that what you're making right now is what you will always make, that this stripped away that illusion and allows you to see that you can have an influence on the outcome. There are things that are under your control, and I would encourage you, Brad would encourage you, just to continue to position yourself to create your own luck. And I think what Liz did today is really highlight the practical implications of that choice. If you got value from today's episode, and if you've been getting value from the episodes up to this point, just take 1 second and press the subscribe button on the platform you're listening to this on. Just lets the providers know you're getting value from the show and you want to be here when we produce additional content. If you want to support us in what we're doing here at Choose FI, here are 4 easy ways. 1, leave us an iTunes review. To do that, just go to choosefi.com/iTunes. 2, use our page to sign up for travel credit cards. If you want to travel the world with miles and points instead of your hard-earned dollars, then just go to choosefi.com/cards and get started today. 3, if you're working on the milestones of FI, set up a personal capital account to track your progress and use our affiliate link. It's completely free and just go to choosefi.com/PC. P as in Paul, C as in Cat. And 4, and most importantly, find your friends, coworkers, and family members who might be open to this message and tell them about the podcast. Have them start with episode 100. It is a fantastic starting place. All right, my friends, the fire is spreading. We'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.
You've been listening to Choose FI Radio Podcast, where we help middle-class America build wealth, one life hack at a time.